Miami's housing laws for sex offenders among the strictest in the nation. Are they humane? Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Officially, it's known as the Lauren Book Child Safety Ordinance. It forces certain sex offenders and predators to stay a minimum of 2,500 feet from schools. In Miami, that leaves very few places where one can live.
Whenever the police just come over and say, you can't be here, well, this is where they put us. And they say, well, you got to just take a walk, just keep walking. So where do we go?
We'll meet the reporters of a new project called Banished that looks at the story of some of these offenders and how they try to survive in Miami. Plus, we'll meet the author of the October Sundial Book Club. This month's title is Veins of the Ocean by Patricia Engel. Finally, we'll learn about a community band open to anyone that's been around more than half a century in North Miami. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us. Just before we get started, just a reminder that this is the October Sundial Book Club. Title is The Veins of the Ocean, and we're going to hear from the author today on this program, so stay tuned for that. Don't go anywhere. But first, Miami-Dade County has among the strictest housing policies for registered sex offenders in the country. Passed back in 2010, the Lauren Book Child Safety Ordinance prevents sex offenders with victims under the age of 16 from living within 2,500 feet of any school. The policy has put hundreds of sex offenders in limbo, as affordable housing within these parameters is hard to find, and many have become homeless. The story gained national attention when a large community of sex offenders began living under the Julia Tuttle Causeway, one of the few places that fell under those requirements, and it was the subject of This American Life.
This next story takes place under a bridge. You may have heard about this bridge, where a bunch of ex-cons, sex offenders, set up camp in Miami.
South Florida is known for sun, sand, and surf, but the welcoming committee on your way to Miami Beach is now this: convicted sex offenders. They are pitching tents and camping out by the Julia Tuttle Causeway.
You may have seen them when you drive by and wondered why they're there.
Well, the community under the Julia Tuttle Causeway has since been cleared out, but the housing complications for sex offenders in this county remain. The Marshall Project, a Pulitzer-winning online magazine focused on criminal justice, recently released a multimedia investigation examining the issue in depth. Reporter Beth Schwartzapfel joins us from the studios of WBUR in Boston. Beth, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Also joining us is reporter Emily Cassie, who joins us from NPR Studios in New York. Emily, it's such a pleasure.
Pleasure's all mine. Thanks for having us.
This is a fascinating story, and one that many of us who've lived here long enough are very familiar with. And just as a note, too, we've reported on where some of these folks have gone because, again, they're not under the Julia Tuttle Causeway anymore and have moved to other parts and are living in, some of them, I believe, in an industrial park here in Miami-Dade County. Again, they're very limited as to where they can go. Emily, the scope of this problem in Miami-Dade County, how many registered sex offenders are we talking about who are still homeless?
So there are about 2,200 registered sex offenders in Miami-Dade County, and nearly 500 of those are homeless. And this is obviously a huge portion of the sex offender population. But it's also a huge portion of the homeless population. The Homeless Trust in Miami-Dade estimates that there are just over 1,000 unsheltered homeless people. That doesn't include sex offenders. So if we think about that 500 population of sex offenders, we're talking about a third of the homeless population in Miami-Dade County.
And where can registered sex offenders currently live in the county?
Well, if they have offended against a child, they will have to live within outside of 2,500 feet from a school, as per county regulations. As per state regulations, it's 1,000 feet from schools, daycares, and parks. And then you have the ocean on one side and the Everglades on the other. So this really leaves these tiny pockets of land in, as you mentioned, industrial zones, on street corners. And when there is housing, it's often unaffordable, or the landlord doesn't want registered sex offenders living there.
And how are these locations monitored, by the way?
Well, this is really a two-pronged process. So they have to register their address with the Miami-Dade Police and the Sex Offender Unit every time they move addresses. And they also have to register that same address with probation. So if they're on probation, then they're going to be monitored with ankle bracelets and GPS trackers. But the Sex Offender Unit with the Miami-Dade Police is also doing spot checks every week and checking that people are at the addresses that they signed up for.
Beth, why did the Marshall Project want to investigate this particular issue in Miami-Dade County?
Well, the Marshall Project covers the criminal justice system, and we often joke that unlike the Innocence Project, we're sort of like the Guilty Project. We look at how our system, handles everybody. No matter what crime you committed, it reflects badly on all of us, you know, as a society, if everybody isn't treated with a sort of basic level of human dignity. And, there's very few populations who are treated with less dignity and decency and humanity by our criminal justice system than sex offenders. You know, it's easy to see why, right? Politicians can pass stricter and stricter laws, and there's not going to be very many people raise their hand and say, hey, I don't think you should be so mean to sex offenders. But Miami-Dade is sort of what happens when you follow that pattern to its logical extreme, where you end up with hundreds and hundreds of homeless sex offenders, and the county just kind of throws up their hands and they say, well, I don't know. They're dangerous. I don't know what to do with them.
And how does Miami-Dade compare to other counties, other cities around the country and how it did? Because as you said, this is what it looks like when it goes to extremes. But are there any other places that have also pushed it to extremes like we have here?
Definitely. There are about 30 states that have residency restrictions of some kind, and then there are thousands of cities and counties around the country that also have residency restrictions. The places where you see it make this kind of dramatic impact are the densely populated areas like cities. So we've seen something like this happen in San Diego. We actually heard from readers after the story came out that it's happening in Milwaukee. Cities where you have housing close together and schools everywhere are where you see it play out. You know, in rural areas, schools or houses might be 2,500 feet apart just naturally because that's how the nature of rural areas. But it's places like cities where you see very strict rules like this lead to these kind of extreme situations.
Emily, talk about the process, for finding some of the individuals that you followed throughout the course of this reporting. I mean, is it just a matter of walking up and just talking to people?
So there was a pastor, Frank Diaz, who works with an organization called United We Can. Beth and I were in touch with him. And when I landed in Miami, I met up with Pastor Diaz, and he took me around to meet with some of these individuals. He works a lot with these communities, providing food and prayer with them. So he has forged this kind of trust and relationship with these communities. So we actually went through a drive in Miami-Dade County, where we went from street corner to street corner, 10 blocks up this way, 2 blocks down that way. And I was introduced to them that way. And when I met Dale, who was one of the main characters, he was kind of picking up all of his tent and supplies that he was hiding out in the brush so that people didn't steal it. So I kind of followed him. And then when Beth arrived the next day together, you know, we really narrowed down who we were going to follow through their journey.
Let's talk about one of the young men that you also interviewed. This one, his name is Stretch. And here's a little bit from the documentary footage on your piece.
When I was 19 years old, I've been accused of inappropriately touching my niece. The pressure was put on me saying, if I go to trial, I'm going to lose. I'm going to get a life sentence. I never see the light of day again. And out of fear, you know, I signed an 8-year deal. When I got out of prison, I was 26 years old.
So where is Stretch living when you found him?
So he was sleeping under this really thin archway in just under this industrial building. There were bright street lamps around him and some other men who were scattered sleeping around him. And he had a chair and he had a backpack with a change of clothes and a few other supplies. He had just gotten a job at a fast food restaurant, which he was really excited about. And we met him really that first night just sleeping under that arch.
And, I mean, has he had any luck in finding any kind of housing? What are his options?
He has not, and his options are really limited. He, first of all, needs to be able to work and sustain jobs that so that he can save up to be able to afford a place. And then there are so few places in Miami-Dade for these guys that he has trouble anyways finding a place. Now, the thing that's kind of ironic about it is that he has family and he has a home. So when he's done sleeping through his curfew on this street corner, he goes home to his family and takes a shower and eats and then goes to work. So he actually has a place to stay, but because it's within the 2,500-foot limit, he cannot stay there. So he'll be spending years out on the street until he can save enough money and convince a landlord to let him stay somewhere.
You know, Beth, many of these folks have to be on probation once they're released. But what are probation officers telling them about where to go, where to live?
Well, part of the mess here is that there's some cross wires and different people insisting different things. So probation is insisting they don't tell anyone where to go. They don't say, you should go here, you should go there. They only approve addresses that folks bring to them. In practice, you know, we heard a lot of guys saying, my probation officer sent me here. There was one instance where this map of the Everglades was circulating in one of the camps, and an officer with the Miami-Dade Sex Crimes Unit had written something like, this is a good address, or something like that, and signed it. And you know, people were outraged. Look, they're sending us to the Everglades. And then police disputed, no, that was just an address someone brought to us. So, you know, we don't exactly know some combination of how folks end up on one corner or another. Word of mouth, somebody's probation officer told somebody, text messages, etc. All we know is that there are very few options for people. So, you know, even the smallest tip turns into what Stretch called to us a military secret.
And remind us, what happens if you violate that 2,500-foot rule?
Well, if you're found to be living within 2,500 feet of a school and you're a sex offender with a victim under 16, you could go to jail for 60 days. Even a landlord who rents to a sex offender in violation of this rule can go to jail. The sex offender could go to jail for up to a year. The landlord could go to jail for 60 days. If you're on probation, which many of these guys are, that's a violation of your probation. You could go back to prison for years.
And this is the 10 p.m. to 6 a.m. curfew that you guys mentioned just a second ago.
Everybody's curfew is slightly different,
okay.
But yeah, if you're on probation, that comes with a curfew, and you have to be at your registered location during those hours.
Mm. I'm talking with Marshall Project reporters Emily Cassie and Beth Schwartz-Apfel. They're behind the new multimedia investigative piece, Banished, which examines the strict housing restrictions for registered sex offenders in Miami-Dade County. Emily's joining us from NPR Studios in New York City. Beth is joining us from WBUR in Boston. Emily, one of the essential characters to know for the story is Ron Book. He's the chairman of the Homeless Initiative, and he's one of Miami's premier lobbyists. Tell us a little bit about Ron's personal connection to this issue, though, of sex offenders.
So sadly, Ron Book's daughter was molested and assaulted by her nanny when she was just 11 years old. And she faced, you know, horrific sexual abuse, which was very difficult for the family to deal with. Lauren is now a senator and is now doing a lot of work around this issue. But that really, you know, set Ron Book off to be getting involved in so many of these laws to restrict access for sex offenders and, in his mind, keep them as far away as possible from children.
And Beth, Ron played a very, just as Emily was touching, he played a very significant role in the passage of Miami-Dade's restrictive policies.
Oh, definitely. Ron Book was a champion of this law. Before this law, there were more than 100 local cities and towns that passed their own version of this law, and he traveled up and down the state lobbying on behalf of all of these restrictive housing policies. And given that his sort of niche as a lobbyist is lobbying on behalf of cities and counties in Tallahassee, it's really hard to overstate how influential he is. He has friends, he has favors, he has campaign donations in city and town halls all up and down the state.
Emily, Ron, as you said, is steadfast on this position. This is, again, from the documentary. Here's a piece of Ron Book.
If you're asking me whether or not I think predators and offenders and pedophiles should live inside our communities where, you know, kids are, I would certainly discourage that. They committed a crime that our society has said, we're going to treat you different for the rest of your lives. And that's just the way it is.
So, Emily, in your conversations with him, do you get any impression that he might be willing to negotiate at all on these requirements, or is he just going to stick to this and say, no, he doesn't want them anywhere near anybody?
That's correct. Our impression is really that he's not interested in budging whatsoever on this issue. In fact, in our conversations with him, you know, he said that if he could impose more restrictions, if he could restrict them further, he would. These are not people he wants integrating into a society with children in it. So he has not budged on this and is really steadfast in his perspective on the issue.
Even though this issue has gotten national attention, not just the fact that it was a This American Life episode, but I mean, I remember living, not living in the area, but I remember when this story broke and it made national news. Even with that hasn't budged him at all.
Not at all. And he actually described this to us, the people kind of pushing back against this law, as a sort of cult. And has a hard time reconciling this idea that expanding the ability for sex offenders to have housing wouldn't necessarily put any children in jeopardy. So there's a real kind of tension there, because even though, you know, these guys are restricted at nighttime and they can't actually go to schools because the kids aren't even there. So you would think, oh, why aren't they restricted, you know, during the day, then at night? He's truly believes that this law is what's keeping children safe. And so he, as far as we know, will not budge on this.
Beth, you've spoke with researchers that have examined the impact of these restrictive policies and what they may mean for sex offenders recommitting acts. But what does the data suggest about, you know, the efficacy of this kind of policy?
Yeah, researchers in this field pretty universally agree that this policy does not prevent sex crimes. And if anything, it actually increases the risk of crime. Because when you cut people off from family, when you cut them off from their treatment, from their therapy, from work, these are all the things that researchers call pro-social, basically things that make you a contributing member of society. Then you become somebody with nothing to lose. And people with nothing to lose have few incentives to make good choices. As far as police are concerned, it also makes it difficult to keep an eye on people if they're homeless. So in general, the research suggests very strongly that, if anything, these policies are actually counterproductive.
Let's hear from one other person. You had mentioned this one before, Dale Brown. Let's hear a little bit of his story.
I'm a sexual predator. I used to be a teacher. I molested several girls. I touched their private parts. I ruined their lives. And I'm going to live with that for the rest of my life.
So from both of you, I'm curious, you know, you've covered stories in the past of sexual abuse, and Emily especially, I believe, you know, from the victim's perspective. How do you cover this story from the perpetrator's perspective? You know, what's the approach? How do you approach someone like Dale Brown?
It's difficult. As you mentioned, I've covered sexual abuse and survivors of sexual abuse in a myriad of contexts, whether it be, you know, sex trafficking across the Saharan Desert, through, you know, women who have been sexually abused by guards in immigration detention. So, you know, having known the experience of what it is to really endure something as horrific as sexual abuse, especially as children, it's a very difficult situation to be in, but I think it comes down to, these are people who have served their time. These are not people who have not yet been convicted or have, you know, perpetrated and are not serving prison time. These are people who have served their time. They've been deemed, they've been given a sentence by the justice system, and now they're trying to restart their lives. And I guess the question that came up for Beth and I a lot is, you know, do we have a duty to treat them with basic, you know, respect and humanity? Do they need food and water and shelter and these kind of basic things? And so, as much as it was, you know, difficult to reconcile that the person in front of you has committed a crime that's, you know, deeply horrific and traumatizing.
And Beth, I wanted to know real quickly from you, is it the people can't accept these folks? Is it because of the crime they committed, or because they don't believe that these folks can be rehabilitated?
Honestly, I don't think anybody thinks that deeply about it. I mean, I'm sure, you know, somebody like Ron Book certainly thinks a lot about it, but I think the general public just has this knee-jerk revulsion. And so when a politician says, you know, let's banish sex offenders, you know, let's put these restrictions on them, I think there's just this instinctive, you know, sense from voters that, yes, great idea. And I don't think anybody kind of takes the next step and thinks, okay, well, if that's what we're going to do, then what? Then what happens? And what we've tried to do with this piece is just answer that question. Here's what.
And Beth, do you get the impression that there's any political will to change any of these policies or update them in any way?
I'm really sorry to say that I do not think there is. Until there's a constituency who's going to stand behind sex offenders and say enough is enough, politicians really just don't have any incentive to do that.
And Emily, you know, in this reporting, I mean, just I apologize for interrupting you earlier, but was there anything from your reporting on this? Because you spent time with these folks. You were out there with them for quite some time. Did anything shock you?
To me, I think it was just that this, unless something changes, this is forever. So this kind of nightly routine of having to sleep on the street in these really abysmal conditions is not just for a week, is not just for a month, is not just for a year, but forever, unless this changes. And that was really what stuck most with me.
You've heard from the Marshall Project reporters, Emily Cassie and Beth Schwartz-Apfel. They're behind the new multimedia investigative piece, Banished. It examines the strict housing policies for registered sex offenders in Miami-Dade County. Emily was joining us from NPR Studios in New York City. Beth is joining us from the WBUR Studios in Boston. Emily, Beth, thank you so much for this. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having us.
And by the way, you can get a link to their piece on our Facebook page, WLRN Sundial. Don't forget, you can always go to our Facebook page, WLRN Sundial, to keep up with the latest on the program. And if you want to listen to Sundial on the go, just subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. Well, still to come, we're going to meet October's Sundial Book Club author, Patricia Engel. That's next on Sundial here on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. We are now in October and the second title of our Sundial Book Club. And for this month, we chose Patricia Engel's 2016 novel, The Veins of the Ocean. It is the Dayton Literary Peace Prize winner, the New York Times Editor's Choice, and the International Latino Book Award finalist. It follows a young Colombian woman named Reina, who fights to protect her family from one horrific tragedy after another. She ends up alone in the Keys, trying to find a sense of home, always wondering if maybe it means going back to Colombia. But in the quiet solitude of island life, she meets a Cuban man who is also searching for home, which is in the arms of his children, still living in the communist island. It's a story about being in exile, both physically and emotionally. It's about imprisonment and isolation. It's about finding one's identity after tragedy. We recently spoke with Patricia Engel about her novel, and we should note, much of this book deals with issues surrounding familial murder, which some listeners may find uncomfortable. Patricia said the idea for the novel came from a strange conversation that she had once with her mother.
Almost 10 years ago, I was driving with my mother past a bridge, and she said to me out of nowhere, that bridge over there, a long time ago, a man threw a baby off of it. And she didn't know any of the details surrounding that event. She only knew that it happened. She didn't know what happened, if the baby lived or died, or what circumstances led up to it. So all I was left with was this image of a man throwing a child over a bridge. And I thought, oh my God. First, the shock of it, you know, it took some time to absorb. But then I started to wonder what could have led up to that moment, what could have pushed a man to do something like that, and what happened to all the people who were connected to that child and to that man. So at the time, I was working on another book, Vida, my first book, and then I even wrote another book, It's Not Love, It's Just Paris. And all the time, I had this image in the back of my mind, and I thought that I would return to it in a story or in a novel or somehow. So the first thing that I did in about 2009 was I wrote a short story called The Bridge, which was published by The Atlantic. And it's just the story of that family that and how that event was such a traumatic event and really shaped the family's history in huge ways. And that was published. And I wrote another novel And for some reason, even though I write many short stories that stay as short stories, they don't turn into novels, that story, The Bridge, stayed with me in a way that other stories haven't. And I decided that I wanted to return to it in order to make it a novel.
And right off the bat, I mean, you take us to that bridge. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is where the novel starts. One of the themes that kind of kept going throughout the story is this idea that, you know, the sins of the parents are carried on through the children. Because this bridge we keep coming back to, and yes, you have one father who tries to throw his child over the bridge. Later, you have another father who throws his child over the bridge. Go a little bit into detail about this idea of how children can carry, you know, that anger, the rage, the violence from their parents from generation to generation, because this family seems like it's a long train of tragedy.
Yeah, one of the challenges of actually writing it, taking an image, a single image, and converting it into a story was to figure out who was going to tell this story, who would have the access to all the information of what actually happened before, during, and after. And I struggled for a while trying to decide if the baby, the surviving baby, should tell the story, you know, as an adult, or the man, you know, who actually committed the crime, or a witness, an innocent bystander. And I came up with the sister to the baby who was thrown over the bridge, and she's the one who's closest to them all. So she has the ability to not feel judgment, you know, she has empathy because she's connected to them by blood. But at the same time, she has all the information necessary to convey that to the reader.
And that's our protagonist,
yeah,
Reyna.
Yeah, that's Reyna. So she's the narrator of the story. But at the same time, she bears the burden of that crime because the original crime was committed by her father, of course, against her brother when he was a baby. And then the crime was repeated by her brother doing the same to his girlfriend's child. And I wanted to explore that, too, how trauma is often repeated, even when it goes against all our impulses to do so. And even more, I was interested in exploring how the families of the incarcerated deal with the fact that someone they have loved, a brother or a son, has done something terrible, unforgivable. And that's a very specific kind of trauma, I think. It's one that's not imposed on them directly, but indirectly, but they suffer alongside the person who's, you know, living out their sentence in prison. They suffer with shame publicly. And so it's kind of a, what are those called? Those Russian nesting dolls of trauma, right? There's all sorts of trauma that Reyna has assumed in her own life, personally, privately, in her childhood. But then there's trauma that she's inherited from her mother and her grandmother, even. But then there's also this kinds of, trauma that she has acquired as a result of her brother's actions.
So you've been describing Reyna, because I wanted to know who she is, mm-hmm. and a little bit more about how you explain who Reyna is, you know, to someone who hasn't read the book yet.
Reyna, to me, is someone who is far more intelligent than she's given credit for, because she's what some people would consider undereducated, and no one has ever had high hopes for her.
And she spends her life doing what her mother did.
Yes, she paints nails. She's been underestimated and undervalued by basically everyone in her community, even in her own family. But she possesses an intelligence and a wisdom that she's not even aware of, because she hasn't been raised to value that about herself. She's a person who has endured a lot, suffered a lot, which has given her strength. But she's still in the process of understanding all that she needs to overcome. And in order to sort of live in the peace and happiness that she's entitled to.
You describe how, at the beginning, how this idea really came from this story, mm-hmm. of somebody who, and this, by the way, this story is like, I looking up, I remember there was a man in Tampa.
Yes.
Some years back, 2015.
Case. Yes.
Threw his 5-year-old daughter over the bridge. So this is a story that's happened.
You know, the funny thing is, once I wrote this, I thought it was such an out there situation, such an anomaly. But once I published the story, people started sending me news clippings. Apparently, this happens all the time.
Right.
It just happened in New York quite recently. Somebody threw a child off of, I think it was the George Washington Bridge or off the Palisades cliffs. And it's really not that rare.
I know it is because it was such a jolting moment, but it took a second afterward to think, wait a minute, this has actually happened. Is Raina or any of the characters in the story in any way based on people you know?
You know, in order to write any character in any story or book, they all have to become people that I know. They all have to become people that I know very intimately, and they all have to become parts of myself. The answer is yes and no. In order to kind of liberate them to have their own story and determine their own fates, I have to let them be who they are on the page and not dictate them based on people that I've known in real life. But the interest, of course, always comes from personal life. I've always been interested in how the families of the incarcerated deal with reconciling their love with their shame or their disapproval a crime committed by someone they love that has deemed them unforgivable and even unfit for society. And in the case of Reina's brother, he's sentenced to death. You know, the judge has determined he does not deserve to live. And what do you do with that? What do you do with that love when you love someone who the society says they don't deserve to live? Love doesn't go away.
And we get a little bit of that. I mean, so many different characters have to respond to this crime, and it's fascinating how each of them do. I wanted you to read a small passage to give us a picture of Raina. This is early on in her life, and I think that it kind of paints a beautiful picture of her relationship with her mother and her brother. This, of course, is after the crime had already been committed, the father. So he was no longer in their lives, but I think this is a lovely scene. They're going to the beach, something that her mother loved doing. And, it's also interesting, too, because Carlito, her brother, has a very unique relationship to water because, of course, he was the child thrown over the bridge at the beginning. But if you could read this passage, it gives us this beautiful little idea of this family.
Our mother took to the beach like it was her temple, finding a piece of shore far from the lifeguard stands, boom boxes, and smoky portable grills, spreading a blanket, smoothing the sand lumps underneath before lying down and shutting her eyes to the sun. She forced me, never Carlito, into the ocean with her, and I felt guilty leaving him behind on land. Mommy said the salty air purified the lungs and seawater nourished the skin. She'd pull me in by the hand, take me into her palms, dunk me under the surf like a baptism, and let me float in her arms. I let her because these were some of the few times I had my mother's full attention. Listen to the water, Reina, she whispered, and I let myself be cushioned by the soft rush of waves. If you trust the tide, it will always return you to shore. We didn't yet know about undertows and rip currents, the many ways the ocean can turn on you. Carlito hated getting wet and stayed away from the beach, kicking a soccer ball around on the concrete walkway toward the seawall, down dusty trails through bendy pines, dodging the swarms of mosquitoes and spiderwebs that kept most people out of those paths. I was a faithful little sister, reluctant to go anywhere without him, so I'd always pull myself out of the water and away from Mommy, towel off, and follow my brother. Sometimes Carlito let me kick around with him, but most of the time he just wanted me to cheer him on while he battered the ball, shouting, "Go, Carlito! Viva Carlito!" And after, he'd kick an imaginary goal, he'd do a little dance, and I'd scream so hard I'd almost make myself cry.
I'm speaking with Patricia Engel. She's the author of the book Veins of the Ocean. The story takes place here in South Florida and in Colombia and in Cuba, and it deals with the issues of family, tragedy, and incarceration. It's the October title in our Sundial Book Club. You can find us on Facebook, look up our Facebook group, and ask to join. We'd love to have you. Some time passes, and really the family kind of dissolves pretty much. And Reina has to escape, and she really has to go into sort of an exile. And she is an exile throughout the story. I mean, she's Colombian, but she's living in this country, and she's constantly, it seems, trying to find a sense of home. But first, I wanted to get an understanding. Why did you decide that she had to move to the Florida Keys?
Well, in a lot of ways, it's a book about displacement, right? It's about emotional exile, geographic exile. And Reina came to the United States as a baby. So she was, you know, one of those involuntary immigrants, right? Her parents brought her here, took her away from her birth country. So I wanted her to choose where she would live. And of course, at that moment, she wants to get away from everyone who knows her. And she's grown up in this very small South Florida community and kind of living in the public shame because of her brother being in the headlines. And then that is all brought about again with his death. So I knew that she would want to reinvent herself, or at least live life without reminders of everything she represents to other people, you know, as this kind of living representation of this horrible crime committed by her brother.
And in the Keys seems like that place where there's just a seclusion, a disconnect from
yes,
the rest of the world.
It is very close, but it's also a world away.
There she meets Nesto. How do you describe Nesto? Who is he?
Nesto was a very recently arrived Cuban exile. His is a family who did not leave with the revolution. They stayed, and they're the ones who have kind of had to endure all the failed promises of those who had faith in what the revolution could offer them. He is the father of two children. He's in a broken marriage, and he leaves very reluctantly and with a lot of conflict to come to the United States, hoping to be able to better provide for his family who are really suffering and enduring a lot of hardship back in Havana.
They both are exiles. They're both looking for a sense of home, but I get the idea. I mean, Nesto, he knows what home is. It's being with family. Not necessarily. He has this connection with Cuba. He misses it, but he also has a disillusion with Cuba. But home seems to me is family. And she's trying to find an idea of home. She had that family. But what are they both looking for? How did they come together? Why are they such a good match?
Well, they come together in a sort of quiet friendship that turns into companionship because they're both very lonely people. They're both adrift. Nesto is looking just to provide for his family, and he sustains himself on the vision of being reunited with them, with being able to bring them over to join him in the United States. And of course, that's his struggle throughout the novel. Reina is really just trying to get through the day. She's just trying to understand what life is without being in the shadow of her brother, because she has spent the last 7 years of her life faithfully visiting her brother in prison. And her whole life has been dictated by that. She's been living almost her own prison sentence parallel to that. And her mother has essentially abandoned her because her mother can't really deal with the pain of it all. And she's made a new life with a boyfriend up in Orlando. So they are both adrift. In that solitude, they fall into that companionship with one another, and also with the natural world that surrounds them down there in the Keys.
As I mentioned before, Reina wants to find that sense of home. Part of it is to get back to Colombia. And she does go. Mm-hmm. She eventually goes back. And it seems like her response to it is, okay. And I've seen this before in people. Like, going back home, you have your memories of home, and it's never the same. Mm-hmm. It you go back thinking you're going to return to something. Why is that?
Well, in Reina's case, her relationship to home is one of, it's a bit of a mix of pain and nostalgia. And by the time she goes back there after her brother dies, because all her memories of being in Cartagena, where she's from, is being with her mother and her brother and her grandmother, never just on her own. By the time she goes back, she's fully on her own. Her mother has no interest in going back. Her brother's, of course, dead. And her grandmother is dead by that time, too. So she's totally alone there. And then it just becomes a place, you know.
She even goes back to their old home and walks through it. And just, it doesn't feel the same.
No, it's not the same. And of course, it's not the same. It's not the same because the people she loved are not there. It's empty. It's just a space. And because of that, she then makes the trip to go meet Nesto in Havana. And she sees that, of course, for him, home represents a very different reality, a very painful one. But he's also surrounded by love in a very different way there.
You have this beautiful imagery in the story where Nesto takes Reina out to sea, and they go very far out to go deep diving. And then we're talking about diving without equipment. They're just deep diving out in the blue sea. Have you had such an experience?
Yeah, I'm kind of a really intense researcher when I'm writing something. So just like I made trips to Cuba and to Cartagena in order to write my characters' homelands, I took up free diving in order to be able to better write the experience of what it is to, you know, throw yourself into the ocean with nothing but your own breath to sustain you. So I became a certified free diver. I studied that down here in South Florida. And it is definitely an experience like any other. I was a scuba diver before that, and it is completely, completely different.
So I think about the other aspects of the story, right? You have a time when she's working at an aquarium and dealing with dolphins. And then, of course, she's visiting her brother in the prison. You spend a lot of time researching aquariums? You spend a lot of time researching prisons?
Yes. Yeah. I've always been interested in just the American incarceration system, which is, you know, is so flawed in so many ways. I've been to prisons. Yeah. And I think also I moved to Florida 14 years ago and, from New York. And when I moved here, I was really impacted by how different the Florida incarceration system is compared to other states. And I was really shocked by how many executions happen here. And the death penalty is something people don't give much thought to. So I really wanted to get into that. You know, the United States is one of the few countries in the world where the death penalty is still practiced. For me, I consider it a barbarism. And countries that we consider, you know, to be violating human rights policies don't even do that. So I wanted to get into that. So I did some research, particularly in the families of the incarcerated, the families of people who are on death row. And I've been interested in captivity, the parallels between what we do to humans, what we do to animals, what we do to the natural world, all the ways that we exploit it and we undermine the rights of living creatures.
What do you want the reader to take away from this story? Or do you just leave it up to them?
Well, in everything that I write, I hope the reader comes from the experience of reading something that I've written, a story or a novel, feeling more compassionate and with a deeper understanding of the human experience, even if it's something that's very far from their reality and their own personal experience. I write a lot of flawed people and without judgment, and I hope that the reader then can kind of maybe take a step back and look at their own maybe prejudices and ways that they've you know, overlooked certain people in our society.
Patricia Engel, author of the 2016 novel Veins of the Ocean, that is the October title for the Sundial Book Club. Patricia, it's been such a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Lewis.
And remember, you can find us on Facebook, look up the Sundial Book Club, ask to join, and you are welcome to join. We want as many of you as possible. All right, still to come, we're going to meet some of the members of a North Miami community band that's been performing for more than half a century. That's coming up next on Sundial here on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Well, that is the North Miami Community Concert Band performing at the Gwen Margolis Community Center in March of 2014. They're often referred to as the North Miami Pops Band, and in September, they kicked off their new performance season. They perform the third Sunday of every month, starting in September, and they go through May. The musicians in the band are volunteers, and members range from age 18 to 80. The band has been performing for more than 50 years in the city. Their next concert will be October 21st, and I'm going to be there as well, so even more fun. Well, joining us now to talk about the new season are volunteer musicians Victoria Sigler and George Early. George, by the way, is also a volunteer here at WLRN. Victoria was a circuit judge in Miami-Dade County until she retired in 2005. Victoria, George, such a pleasure. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for inviting us.
Thank you for having us for your audience today.
Oh, it's such a pleasure. You know, Victoria, real quickly, this band goes back more than 50 years. Take us back to when it started. Who started this?
Well, The band started before I was part of the organization, but having spoken with some of the founding members, it started out as an informal group of musicians that got together, jammed, did events in the community as early as the 1950s. They became a more formal organization in 1982 when they were incorporated by Hal Orme and his wife, Jeannie Orme, and a gentleman by the name of Sal Rosen, and then they became a more structured, organized performing orchestra.
What kind of music do you play?
We provide music that comes from what we call the American Songbook. For example, the last concert we did, we do big band music, Dorsey, Miller. We did some Elton John, Lion King, Phantom of the Opera. Of course, you can't do a band without marches.
Exactly. What do you play?
I won't claim to play anything well, but I started out with them as a trombone player. There was only two other trombone players, so I became third seat trombone. Then they got another trombone player, and I became fourth seat of trombone. But lately, we've had some need to have somebody play in percussion and bells. So I've been actually playing the bells, and last week I got to play the timpanis, the big kettle drums.
See, this is kind of cool because it's this community band, so people can just play a lot of different instruments. George, you play the trumpet.
I play the trumpet, yes. I'm not as multifunctional as Vicky. You know, I'm catching the devil with the trumpet, trust me.
How long you been playing?
I've been playing trumpet for 5 years. I played trombone in school for 5 years, but I should have probably gone back to the trombone because this trumpet killing me.
You practice a lot, though. You get up early in the morning to practice.
Yes.
7 days a week, right?
7 days a week, yes, sir.
What time do you get up?
I'm usually up between 1 and 3.
Hold on a second. How are you practicing at that hour and not waking everybody up?
I have a muffler.
Okay.
They have a sound in them for the, so yeah. You just plug it in and then play, you know.
Why did you want to join this band? How did you find out about it?
Her. You know, she wanted to beat me to death, but she was the one because I knew good and well I have about as much business in that band as I do running up and down I-95 and stuff. But it was a challenge because I met her at the University of Miami. Uh-huh. We have a band there. It's for beginnings, old people, and for seniors, you know.
Victoria, how did you get involved?
I saw an article in the Miami Herald about an upcoming concert, and the last paragraph said musicians wanted, and I was hoping they defined that term loosely. So I showed up and got to play the December concert. I got to play the bells. I only had two notes, but it was fun.
So, yeah, are you guys trained at all? I mean, you don't have to have a lot of experience. When you show up, I mean, what do you have to be able to do?
Actually, it's a good idea we got people that's been playing for 70 years. We have people that's been playing for 70 years.
Okay.
Okay, and her and I, I'm doing good with 5.
You know, you get up at 1 in the morning and practice.
Yeah, but I have to. It's either that or unemployment, you know.
What, you know, the other thing, Victoria, is you're looking for volunteers all the time, right? Are you still looking for volunteers?
Certainly. The unique part about this orchestra is you don't have to audition. Where it's not an orchestra where there's technically a first seat, a second seat, or a third seat, or no seat at all. They let musicians perform in a non-competitive environment, and you sit down with the music, rehearse every week, and if you're ready for the concert, you play.
But you got to be able to read music, though, right?
That is helpful unless you're a percussionist. Yeah.
Unless you're okay, gotcha.
Vicky plays her own things, but most of us have to read it.
You're just ripping on her right now. So this
she'll get me later.
This show that's coming up on later
the
21st. Mm-hmm. What are you guys going to be playing?
I don't have the. You got the.
Do we know?
No, but we are going to be playing an assortment of a couple of marching band pieces. We'll have some Henry Fillmore. He wrote music for the University of Miami in the 20s. We should have one Mozart, one Tchaikovsky, and a couple of big band pieces. So we cover a wide variety of music.
And you said what's really cool about it is that, again, it's a community band. It's about opening up to the community, not just in performances, but inviting people to come in and be part of it. And you have people ranging in age from 18 to 80. You got people of all kinds in there. So it's an amazing mix. This really is such a cool idea. I really, really appreciate you guys coming in and sharing. Thank you so much.
Well, we appreciate it.
All right. And again, that is Victoria Sigler and George Early, and they are volunteer musicians at the North Miami Pops Band. And again, they're going to be doing a performance coming up here on October 21st. It is going to be their next concert. I'm going to be there as well, so stop on by and say hello, please. We'll have more information on our Facebook page, WLRN Sundial. Well, that's our program for today, this Tuesday, October 9th. I'm Luis Hernandez. Have a wonderful day. Enjoy the music.